Well, welcome everybody to this LSE Ideas event, where we are launching a really exciting new report called The Rise of Insurgent Europeanism. At a moment when everybody's feeling really a bit depressed about the current situation, I think our findings that there is a move towards European pressure for European reform at the grassroots, whereas in the past the grassroots were usually mostly concerned with local issues, is a really quite significant shift in public opinion and the role of a European public sphere. So to tell you all about it, we've got a wonderful group of people. We have Rock, who is one of the main authors of the report, who will tell us the main conclusions of the report. We then have, I haven't given Rock's whole name because it's impossible to pronounce in English, but you can see it on the screen. We have Niccolò Milanese, who's also one of the authors of the report and is going to tell us about the main recommendations of the report. And then we have two wonderful representatives of exactly what we're talking about. One is Mikhaila Pobudova, who's a civil society activist from Slovakia. She's the director of a civil association which supports refugees called Marina, but no doubt she'll tell us more about it. And then we have Marijke Kukuk, who is a politician from this new wonderful transnational European party in the European Parliament, but also in all sorts of places. And we just did very well in the Dutch elections. So it's very exciting. And she, in a way, personifies the new insurgent Europeanism. So it's great to be able to hear from her. And we're hoping, we have another speaker, Charlene Randera from the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna. She's got terribly caught up with something else and she may not be able to join us, but I've said to her, even if she can just join us at the end, we'd love to hear from her. So with that, I will turn over to Rock to start us off. We'll hear from everybody and then we'll have a general discussion.
Good afternoon, everyone. Can you see my slides, please?
Is that okay? Yes.
Yes, so my name is Roch Dunin Vonsovic, and I'm one of the research officers at the Visions of Europe program at LSE Ideas. And I wanted to just describe a little bit in a little bit more detail the process through which we arrived at the vision of the Insurgent Europeanism report and some of its main findings. And then I'll give the floor to Niccolò, who will discuss the implications of the report for European politics and European democracy, as well as for the upcoming conference for the future of Europe. So the report is a result of a two-year study within LSE Ideas, within the Visions of Europe program, and it is inspired, as Mary mentioned, by the studies of subterranean politics that was carried out by some of the members of the team back in 2012. And then again in 2016, at this critical juncture in European and world politics. And at both of those junctures, the diagnosis of the European civil society sphere was that Europe or the EU was a non-issue, especially for grassroots civil society actors. They were not concerned with what was happening on the European political sphere. They were concerned with the here and now, and with their national spheres. Some of those who were pro-European, they took Europe for granted. Our 2018-2020 study, which really happened at the crescendo of a decade of crises that ravaged the continent, shows a shift in civil society's attitudes towards Europe. And it really reflects a new dynamic, what we call an emergence of a new visions of Europe, on the basis of critical re-examination and re-engagement with European politics on various levels of European civil society. As I mentioned, all of this really informs the Conference of the Future of Europe, which hopefully will be launched on Sunday. So the study, just briefly, so the aim of the study was to identify and study transnational civil society. So actors that operate with what we call the European civic space or seek change at the European level. We started with the participants of the European Citizens Initiative, and we snowballed thereafter. The study comprises a detailed analysis of 167 actors scattered across Europe, complemented by 30 in-depth interviews with civil society actors from selected countries that we identified where political polarization had been heightened in previous years, but also countries that lay somewhat on the margins of Europe. So we are interested in the outside look in, so to speak. That was then followed by a participant survey to triangulate the data. But we also met civil society activists. That was pre-pandemic, obviously, during two international conferences, one in London, one in Palermo, which we called the Moments of Dialogue. So we had a pretty robust and varied methodology to arrive at the findings. Essentially, what we argue is that this dynamic realignment of civil society on the issue of Europe fosters the emergence of a European public sphere, something that has been long in the making and something that has been long yearned for by various politicians, pundits, or threatened by others. But Nicola will discuss the parameters of that European public sphere in a little bit more detail. But what we do find is, however, that this dichotomy between for or against Europe, while it still exists to an extent, obviously, it loses its analytical utility when looking at civil society. We find that even right-wing populists do not want to leave or destroy the EU. They want to shape it in their own image. But particularly the more progressive, the more pro-European civil society activists that we have been studying also have changed their attitudes towards Europe. So they're no longer Brussels-centric, for example. So being in Brussels is no longer a prerequisite for participating in the debates on the future of the European Union. So these are very much local issues that drive a lot of those actors, but then are also deliberated and addressed on a transnational scale. But I'll discuss that in a little bit more detail on the next slide. However, we do find that there are three ideal types of civil society activists and actors. So we have what we call traditional Europeanists. So those are people that are communicating the benefits of European integration, that seek change at the institutional level. Some of them are federalists, so they are the traditional breed of civil society actors that deal with Europe, and that are really well plugged into what the critics would call the Brussels bubble. So those are the people who 10 years ago had also been interested in European affairs. They're still here and they still matter, but they're definitely not the most interesting actors that we can find, or the ones that are really pushing the debate on Europe forward from the perspective of civil society. The arrival or the transformation of two other types of actors is what concerns us the most. So these are what we call instrumental Europeanists. So people who create pressure and momentum for the European project, but from the perspective of their own agendas, of their particular goals that often relate to their immediate surroundings. So these are pragmatic Europeanists in the field of consumer rights, ecology, migration, transparency. So those are the people that maybe 10 years ago thought that the only points of contact for their policy agendas were national politicians or local politicians. And now they realize that European policymaking, European politics affects their day-to-day business, but also that they can seek and forge alliances across borders in order to further their goals. But they also are much more aware of the fact that they share the the plight of other actors across the continent. And that's particularly in result of the crises, as I said, that ravaged the continent. So the financial crisis, the euro crisis, the migration crisis, the Brexit, and obviously most recently, the pandemic. So those instrumental Europeanists understand that even the small agendas that are very much locally specific to their localities should and have to be addressed from the European level. And then we have insurgent Europeanists. So those are the ones who create pressure and momentum for progressive change at the European level. These are social movements and campaigns, but also transnational European parties, such as the one that we're hosting today, the member of one of those parties. And these are very much a new type of European civil society that really sees all politics in Europe as European, for whom those distinctions and divisions of the past are no longer valid, and who really refuse to see politics only through a national lens. Another dimension of the report are the visions of Europe that emerge. One second that I forgot. So this is roughly the breakdown of between the types of actors that we found. However, these categories are very much ideal types. So some actors may have some characteristics of both being instrumental or insurgent Europeanists. But this is just to give you a snapshot of what is the breakdown between those three different categories. So we see the traditional and instrumental Europeanists still very much comprise the majority of those actors. But it also matters what civil society now wants from Europe. And the first want, the first vision that is very articulated is for a normative Europe. So they do not want Europe to no, they don't want it to any longer to be a scapegoat to be used by national politicians for their failings. They don't want it to be an arena for intra-governmental bargaining. They want Europe to be guardian of values and norms when it comes to human rights, when it comes to democracy. They say that without norms, without values, the EU loses its sui generis status, its one-of-a-kind quality. It just turns into a trading bloc. They want to go beyond technocracy and this sort of neo-functionalist character of European integration. So they say that, so for them, that dimension of Europe is key. They also want a popular Europe. So while member states remain the primary actors of the European construction, especially legally, our respondents recognize that the social reality of Europe cannot be reduced to the national logic anymore. So citizens, cities, regions should have greater participation in the decision-making process on the European level to make Europe more popular. They want a more bottom-up approach to governance. They're focused on localism. So sometimes some of the more specific and tangible requests are to cut out the middleman of the member state, and create more specific both decision-making but also funding structures that connect the European Union with the local level and the subnational level. But I also mentioned that they very much subscribe to the EU's notion of subsidiarity. So they don't want a totalizing European super state that will take over the prerogatives and responsibilities of every possible level of governance. The EU should only step in when it is absolutely necessary, when those functions cannot be taken up by other smaller entities. And that takes us to the third type, the third vision of Europe that is put forward by civil society, which we call responsive Europe. And this is very much very firmly articulated on the basis of the global threats and the global crises that have affected the continent in the second decade of the 21st century. As I mentioned before, this overlapping cascade of crises, the financial crisis, the euro crisis, the migration crisis, the political crisis of European sovereignty surrounding Brexit, and now very much exacerbated by the pandemic. And we have to take into account that our some of our research took place in early throughout 2020. So this is very much a fresh take on the changes to the social fabric of Europe as articulated by civil society activists. And this is very much a realization that in national independence is a thing of the past of the 19th, if not the 20th century. And it's a civilizational realization. So that migration, that climate, that human security, and increasingly health needs to be addressed by the European Union or by some other structure of a united Europe, because national states alone are incapable or unwilling or just not very good at doing it. And obviously, vaccine procurement with its shaky start, but ultimately gaining momentum, has been a very good example of this. So these new types of practices of civil society that I just discussed vis-a-vis the EU, new types of actors and new types of and new visions have implications for European democracy, especially ahead of the Conference for the Future of Europe. And Nicolò will give us a little bit more details about this.
Great. I was just about to send you a message to say we must move on to Nicolò, although that really gave us a lovely overview of the report. So without further ado, I will turn to Nicolò.
Thanks, Mary, and thanks, Roch, for leading up to me. And Roch's also going to click through the slides. This is teamwork across Europe. Indeed, I'm in Paris. Roch is somewhere in Poland, but we're working together across borders. So what Roch has been describing to you is that the nature of civil society and the nature of politics, to some extent, has been transformed or challenged over the past decade and a half of crises. And what has emerged from that, what we can see in the civil society fabric of Europe, is to some extent an incipient new model of how democracy ought to work, or a kind of prefiguration which just occasionally gets through into the institutions of a different kind of democracy, which we summarily call the 21st century democracy. And so where 20th century democracy had quite a strong division between a vertical dimension, which was about trying to influence power by talking with political parties and governments, and a horizontal dimension, which was about grassroots organization on a range of different issues. Now, not only at a European scale, but in national politics, people have been talking about a 45 degrees form of democracy, which is about finding the sweet spot between horizontal mobilizing approaches and institutional buy-in, if you like, and finding the tension that creates the prospect of change. But what the implications of this change in the nature of politics in general have for European affairs, and given the European dimension of all of these crises, is that an extra dimension is brought in. So it's not just between vertical and horizontal, but there's also a transnational European dimension to the reflections and actions of many civil society actors across Europe. So we call the European political space a kind of third dimension of politics, and these innovative kinds of actors, insurgent actors, are constantly finding and experimenting with a kind of equilibrium between horizontal, vertical, and transnational approaches. And that configuration is what I've tried to describe as an incipient European democracy, which is partly caused by and reacts to and tries to change a slightly dysfunctional European institutional setup. So Roch, if you click through to the next slide, here is a small picture of 45 degree change in three dimensions. If it's small on your screen, you can find it in the report. On one side of your screen in red is the 45 degree theory of change at a national level, where you've got a vertical dimension and a horizontal dimension, and one tries to find an equilibrium between institutional buy-in and horizontal grassroots organization. on the blue side of your screen is the attempt to bring in a third dimension to this, which is about the European dimension. So Rob, click through to the next one. The importance of this today really is that the European Union hasn't looked at the relationship between itself as a set of institutions and civil society since the exercise in creating a draft constitutional treaty around the millennium. And our report shows that a lot has changed in the nature of civil society and politics in those 21 years. And so, as Rock mentioned, we're at the moment of a launch of the Conference on the Future of Europe, originally announced in 2019 by Ursula von der Leyen, and she was named as President of the European Commission, due to be launched last year on the 9th of May, but the pandemic and various interinstitutional disagreements, it has to be said, have led to a delay, which will potentially mean that it's meant to start on the 9th. There's still some threats to delay it even further because there's a lack of agreement between institutions, but we're pretty confident it's going to start this 9th of May. So this Conference on the Future of Europe is meant to think again about the shape of the European Union and the promises that it's going to put citizens at the centre of the discussion about what the European Union ought to look like. There's a great demand from that. The European Commission's own surveys in Eurobarometer show that 90% of Europeans demand that citizens' voices are taken more into account. And if we step back and reflect a little, despite the hiccups in putting together the Conference on the Future of Europe, there's something remarkable about the fact that in the middle of a pandemic, the European Union is engaging in such an exercise at all. It either shows a kind of ambition or a kind of desperation, depending which way you look at it. But they're launching, the European Union is launching this exercise with which has created some big hopes and big promises amongst civil society and citizens. Those civil society actors that have been following the discussions around the Conference on the Future of Europe and the journalists have all in all had a rather negative view of what has been discussed so far. There's been now over a year of delays caused by disagreements between the Council, the Commission, and the Parliament about how this conference ought to be set up, how important its conclusions can be, what the role of citizens ought to be, and how much of a say they will have, and in what ways over the conference. But while this is a familiar story in European affairs, and perhaps civil society organisations that follow European affairs closely have grown a bit too familiar with this institutional bickering, the fact that there's quite a power struggle over this shows that there is some fear on some people's parts that this process will open up some potentials for change, and a desire on other people's parts for saying, well, look, the world around the institutions has changed and we do need to engage with that. And so this institutional battle is in a way a sign that the European Union feels like it has to act and there's a disagreement about how to do it. And we could even see that this kind of institutional blockage, which reflects the current slightly dysfunctional nature of European decision-making, provides precisely a space for the citizens to take some initiative, quite as the, after all, much more dramatic crises, financial crisis, migration crisis, and so on, have led to civil society organizing themselves, well, around the conference as well. There's civil society organizing itself, and I want to mention at least one initiative called Citizens Take Over Europe, which I'm quite strongly involved in. So Rock, carry on to the next slide. The conference is going to go on for the next year and a half, but it's been timed to coincide with the to conclude at the time of the presidential elections here in France, where I currently am. But no doubt the conversation that is launched by the conference will be continuing in the institutions and outside of the institutions for quite some time. And indeed, amongst the European decision makers, there's quite an awareness that sooner or later treaty change will be required in the European Union. And while treaty change is unlikely to emerge from this conference process, it's a little bit like a test run for how treaty change might come about. Our report tries therefore to make proposals about how to secure the productive involvement and the potential of a renewed civil society engagement across Europe in European affairs. And we come up with four proposals for the Conference on the Future of Europe, but indeed much beyond that. And I'll talk you through them very, very quickly. The first is to create a permanent European Citizens' Assembly. As part of the Conference on the Future of Europe, there is going to be some citizens' panels, 200 citizens gathered and four different citizens' panels to deliberate together and feed their recommendations into the plenary of the conference. And already in the institutions, some people are in favour of making this mechanism permanent to engage citizens in decision-making, not only at election times, but on an ongoing basis. We broadly welcome this kind of idea of creating a European Citizens' Assembly. There have been experiments with this kind of thing in national settings. If we think of the Irish Citizens' Assembly, which led to the referendum on abortion, or again here in France, the Climate Assembly, which has made recommendations to the government about how to deal with climate change. Why not do this at a European scale? Why not even give the Strasbourg seat of the parliament over to a citizens' assembly? Second proposal is to empower the regions and cities of Europe to work together with civil society in new formations and find new solutions to common policy challenges. Over the past decade of crisis, we've seen cities and civil society often working together on issues as wide-ranging as housing, access to housing, or how to welcome and then integrate migrants and refugees. Cities have often been taking the lead, and it's an easier, closer to the everyday citizen level at which to bring about political innovation. Why not do more to empower regions and cities to work together across Europe? There's something called the Committee of the Regions, a European institution, which could be, in a certain sense, repurposed precisely to facilitate this. The third recommendation is to have a secure and inclusive European citizenship. There are too many people across Europe who are long-term permanent residents of the European Union but do not have European citizenship. And those of you who are in the UK or are British living in the rest of Europe know the problems that can come with the fragility of European citizenship and how easily it can be taken away. So to underpin this democratic engagement, European citizenship needs to be reinforced. It also needs to be more welcoming by decoupling it from national citizenship so that non-EU nationals can become European citizens. And fourthly and finally, there's the importance of extending and deepening the social pillar. This cycle of crises from 2008, which has transformed European civil society, started with the financial crisis and the gaping inequalities that emerged from it. And this crisis hasn't gone away. And indeed, it's in these past months being deeply exacerbated by the pandemic and the recessions that are being created by it. Just today, the European leaders are meeting in Porto at the European Social Summit. So there is some awareness of the importance of reinforcing the social pillar. But many civil society actors, I think, across Europe would feel that the commitments that are in the Porto summit are by no means ambitious enough, and that the European Union needs to make it absolutely central to its future plans to ensure, for example, minimum income across the European Union, minimum wages, a standardized guaranteed income if you become unemployed, and other measures to reduce inequality and improve protection of people's rights at work. So these are four proposals emerging from our report, which we consider to be really important for the European Union to take seriously, not only because they're important in their own right, but because they're the underpinnings of a kind of productive relationship between a renewed civil society and the European institutions going forward.
Thank you, Nicola. That was great. And now we can actually hear from some of the activists who we were studying, which is very exciting. And I'm going to turn first to Mihaela.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation. And thank you for inviting me to this discussion. I guess I'll just say a little bit about me before I start commenting on the findings of the report. My name is Mihaela Pobudova, and I'm the co-founder and director of Marina, which is a civic association working in Slovakia to support the integration of refugees and migrants. I think the reason why I was relevant for this study was the fact that we were actually born out of the 2015 migration crisis. And the reason why we came to be, why a group of people got together and decided to put together an initiative to support refugees at the time, was that we felt that the political discourse and general media narrative was filled with sort of negative messages about people coming to Europe. And there really was a vacuum or a lack of any positive and constructive messages that would show that Slovakia is a, you know, country that cares and that can show solidarity. So basically a group of people got together and we put together an online campaign that was calling for resettlement of Syrian and Iraqi refugee families to Slovakia. And we were looking for individuals and organizations to pledge that they would personally get involved with the refugees' integration should the government agree to resettle them. This campaign actually got relatively big quite quickly. We really didn't know what it would get to, but we got over 2,000 people who actually signed up and wanted to help out. Unfortunately, the government did not agree to resettle any refugees, but at the time we thought it would be such a pity to just let go of this network and this wheel of people in Slovakia, and we decided to establish an NGO that would support the integration of refugees who were already resident in Slovakia at the time. I would maybe just like to also say before I comment on the findings of the study that I'm going to comment on what I know or what I actually have experience with. So it's in no way definitive, and it definitely does talk from my perspective, from me being and working in Slovakia, which might be different in other countries. So to the vision of Europe, to the normative, popular, and responsive, I would definitely say that I see myself as agreeing with all three. I think the normative one is the one that is the closest to me, and I think that was the one that I responded to most within the survey. For me, Europe is an embodiment of values, of human rights, of social justice, of solidarity. And since Slovakia has signed up to it and is a member of the EU, it's something that I can legitimately claim that Slovakia should uphold. So whatever I do with refugees and we do with refugees and migrants, I see that it directly ties to the values that we have signed up for. And therefore, whatever communication we have with the state, with the government agency, we often mention that, you know, this is in line with you know, what our commitments are or what we have claimed to believe in. So we should do it, and we try to encourage and push the government or local politicians to actually do something about it. I would also just tie this normative vision to me being an instrumentalist. And I think that's definitely where I see myself. When I saw the report, I was thinking about where am I amongst the ones that you named. And I definitely am most the instrumentalist. So we actually, the grassroots movement started with us wanting to work on the ground. So we work directly with local communities. We support individual refugees, children, families. We connect them with locals. We deliver Slovak language classes, further education to refugees. We organize community events, awareness raising events about migration and integration, and so on. So we really are working on the ground. What we have found is that often for us to deliver sustainable solutions, we need to create systemic changes, or we need to push for changes in the law, changes in processes, in the divisions of agendas at governmental offices, and in the creation of new funding mechanisms that would actually enable, you know, integration to be delivered at a consistent quality to all that need it. So what it does to us is that it moves me and my organization closer to the political level, but more in terms of advocating for change or pushing for changes generally at ministerial level. If that doesn't work, we need to push at political level, because often some changes, especially when it comes to relocation mechanisms or resettlements, that tends to be a political decision, not really a governmental or sort of more execution oriented agenda. What we found is that it pushes us closer to the political level, and at the same time, often migration and migration crisis has brought very similar problems to all EU countries, and therefore we have found allies, NGOs working in different states that often, given that they have much more experience with migration and with integration of refugees, they have already put together initiatives or established best practices that we can actually just join or take over and duplicate basically in Slovakia. And therefore we start slowly also moving to the European level on a practical basis. What it then does is that in order to do what we do, we need funding. And we look, first of all, locally. Often there is not enough funding locally because this is not generally a priority. And therefore, we need to look above for funding. And we tend to look at European mechanisms for funding. And European mechanisms very often encourage sort of international cooperation within the EU, which helps us not only to create sort of more lasting partnerships, but help us work together to deliver solutions together on a European level. And the more we know each other, the more there is space to create sort of pan-European advocacy campaigns or initiatives that then we as a small organization, we are happy to join and that we support basically from our local perspective. I would get to the popular vision of Europe. I think as a true civil society representative, I think it's just generally a very common sense demand from our part. I think we really like participative and inclusive processes. And in Slovakia, I've just checked the statistics just to give you relevant information. In the last elections to the European Parliament, we had the lowest turnout. Only 22% of eligible voters actually came to vote. Silver lining is that actually that was the highest turnout of Slovaks in the past four elections, but still very bad. And generally, and I'm closer to my topic, so to refugees and migration, and the sort of most publicly visible issues that came from the EU were quotas for the distribution of refugees, and then last year the EU Pact on Migration and Asylum. And both were seen and commented on by mainstream politicians as something that we don't have to do. They basically there is this understanding that Slovaks think that that's being imposed on us, and we didn't take part in making these decisions. And even mainstream politicians, they work with this information, and they say that we definitely won't have to do it. Don't worry, we don't have to do it. And there's always flexibility. And if anybody would push us to do anything, we will say no. And we'll join the others in the V4, Visegrad 4, our friends in Hungary, Poland, and Czech Republic. And we will not, you know, let anything that is not in our interest happen to us. And this is sort of a very common rhetoric when it comes to the EU in Slovakia. So there's definitely this democratic gap, I think that's what you called it in the report, here in Slovakia with regards to the EU and how Slovaks are represented at the decision table in Brussels. I think what I also would want to add here is that from my perspective in Slovakia, my organization definitely represents a minority attitude. Which means that there is a risk, or a risk depends on who sees it, that should more people participate, which is definitely just a sort of general good, that it would lead to a dissolution of these values that I hold dear. Well then, but that's just a comment, and I'll go on further. With regards to the recommendations, the first one, Permanent Citizens Assembly, that truly sounded like an interesting idea, but what I would find a bit difficult is its execution. I think we would get to the issue of who actually would be represented, how would he or she be chosen, how many people would there be, what their agenda would be, you know, what would be the enforcement of decisions made there. So I'm a little bit worried that we would sort of create an institution that might not actually be functioning as well as we would maybe want it to. But it's definitely up for discussion. The second one about empowering cities, since I work in integration, I would support this 150%. Generally, integration has been proven to be the best practice across the EU, and state integration of refugees and migrants really isn't a functional model. And it has to do with, you know, cities being closer to the city, to the people that live there, and so on, and they can make the best use of resources for those coming in. So I would definitely agree that this would be a great thing to do. Generally, it's something that we're doing here in Slovakia as well. We've piloted an integration center on a municipal level in Nitra. It seems to be working well. What you tend to come across are barriers in terms of funding and agenda, or an understanding that that is sort of my thing to do. We get this sort of pushback from municipalities here where they feel like refugees or migrants are really not their thing, that it's a thing of a state institution. It's a Ministry of Social Affairs and Labor, or Ministry of Interior's business, and not mine. So I think sort of more of an explanation that it is an agenda that is theirs, that they're best placed to deal with it, and also make sure that they're there's available funding for cities to actually deliver integration services to refugees and migrants. The third one about European citizenship, I must admit I know very little about it, and I was wondering about whether there would be any technical advantages or practical advantages to holding a European citizenship. I definitely do see the soft value of a European citizenship, and in it, even if I own it, to sort of reaffirm the equality of citizens across Europe. But it's also, generally just a piece of paper does not make me included from one day to another. And I think any of these sort of more formal measures should definitely be accompanied by more soft measures that support the social cohesion and the prevention of discrimination and racism across Europe. And the last one, fully agreed, just to make sure that it's not just economic measures that address social fractures across the EU, but also measures that support better mutual understanding, tolerance, and respect to differences. And I would end there. I think I might have run out of my time. I apologize. I give the word back to Mary.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for being so thoughtful about all of this and how it relates to your situation. And so now, last but not least, I will turn to Marijke.
Hi, thank you. So also to just start off with a bit of an introduction about who I am. So my name is Marijke Koekoek. I'm a Dutch citizen. I live in the city of Utrecht, which is quite close to Amsterdam. And as mentioned, I was recently elected as a member of parliament in the Netherlands. We had elections on the 17th of March. And I represent Volt, the pan-European party on the national level. And for us, that's a bit of a first. So we are a pan-European party, and we have one member in the European Parliament, and we're also represented at local level in Germany, in Bulgaria, and in Italy. And for us, this is the first time that we're actually also at the national level represented in a political sphere. So this is for us also a very new and exciting time where we see one of our initial objectives actually becoming reality, namely to be present with a similar program, to be present at all three levels of politics, European, national, and local. And so we're at the moment sort of finding out how to best use that and how that looks like in practice. So this report sort of came at the exact right time, and I'm very happy that you were willing to share it with us. When I was reading it, I recognized a lot of things that were said, especially in terms of what was mentioned within the surveys and how people viewed Europe and how they see themselves as Europeans and how they see the European institutions. That's, I think, a lot of it goes to the core of why a party such as Volt actually exists, that we were initially established not as a political party, but more as a political movement or a grassroots movement in response to all kinds of challenges that were represented. So Volt's sort of origin is a direct result of Brexit. So there were actually three Europeans that were friends already. They got together and they saw Brexit happen, and they said, well, this is not how we picture European society, and we want to do something against that. And that's how the ball sort of started rolling. And now we're 3 years further along, and now we're actually part of sort of the political as well. But to me, that was always a very important part of joining Volt, that it was not purely a political mechanism, because I see politics as one of the many means to, in a peaceful way, change society. and not as an end goal in itself. And that's actually also how we see the European institutions. It's not that we see the European Union, the institutional aspect of it, as a goal or as a sort of ideal that has to exist regardless, but it's a means to solve big challenges that we're all facing with. And I think what Michaela was talking about the way that we treat migrants is one of the main challenges that we are right now confronted with, and especially how we keep our common values there. So when I was reading a report, I think what I mostly recognized is this idea of a normative European or starting with common values. And that's probably also why I find that so important. It's because that's something that I've been missing in the European Union for the last maybe 15, 20 years, because we didn't work from common values towards institutionalization. We kind of started with institutions, and there are some common values, but they're not explicated. And I think the criticism of the European Union that we sometimes hear is in some ways correct, is that it functions for a small group of people, it functions for corporations. And one of the core reasons that is the situation right now is that we lack common values. And that's kind of what we tried with Volt to change, or to find people with common ideas about the society, to start with values such as solidarity, other inclusion, but also to work towards social equality. And from there to kind of build up and to see what do you need on what kind of level of government to actually reach that vision, that ideal of the European society in 50 years. So in that sense, I also really liked reading about the 45 degree axis, because I think that is really something that we try to aspire as well, to not be purely political, but to sort of be the political translation of movement on the ground, of grassroots, and especially the local level, because I think most people, the importance of or the value that you feel, or the value that you feel that you represent as citizen in society, starts at the local level, because that's in your own neighborhood, in your own city or town, that's where you feel most at home, that's where you want to see things that you relate to, that's where you want to see your values represented, basically. So I think that is what we in Europe should aspire to, is to have the most important decisions starting at local level. And at the national level, so where I currently am, should sort of refocus in its goal in the political sphere. We should not be the ones that sort of carry the torch, but we should be the ones that take it over and then represent the local concerns at the European level. And the European level is where we should have the broad frame of how we should address challenges. That's in my perspective, the ideal Europe. So a lot of the recommendations in the reports I have here, I can fully subscribe to. I think that's indeed what we should work towards to. And one of the main challenges, I think, there is to work really towards European citizenship. I think it's also one of the most important ones, that we really feel that we should not just have solidarity out of pragmatism, but because we have common tradition, common history. But that's also the hardest, because I think that is where a lot of people feel threatened in their identity. And that there's a huge concern that there will be no room for individuality and no room for local traditional differences anymore. So for us, I think for Volt and for others that are also working in any kind of movement towards this kind of more European feeling, I think the main challenge is to counter that fear through dialogue. And so I'm a huge fan of the Permanent Citizens Assembly, because that, I think, to me is the ideal place to have dialogue, instead of being when you're in any kind of debate, or when you respond to a referendum, it's always a sort of a yes or no question. It simplifies reality too much. And I think citizens' assemblies, local, national, and European level, are the ideal place to get to understand each other. And I think what would be helpful in that as well is to have a sort of Europeanized media, where not just on politics, because now media, when Europe is discussed, it's often about politics, what's going on in Brussels or what did the European Commission do or not do. But I think it's very important for us to meet each other through media. So, for example, to have a European news that sort of zooms in on a town in Italy and on a town in Bulgaria, and to see the similarities and to see the similar challenges that we're faced with. So it sort of speaks to move towards more like a Europe as a coffee shop or coffee house where you meet each other, a cafe, and to move away from Europe as an economic power, or as I think that's the Europe that we've been currently living in, which is basically beneficial to corporations and perhaps to individuals that are already kind of well off. But we should work towards a Europe that works for everybody, and that starts with a local level, with getting to know each other and actually feel more as Europeans. But that's also something that should sort of come from self-reflection and motivation from people. So I think that is where politics can play a marginal role, except that we can provide the right example, and we can also fix the institutional flaws that we have. So I read in the report also, one of the main crises that brought Europeans together was the euro crisis, and where a lot of countries were hurt is because we don't have the fiscal measures to mitigate the negative consequences of financial crisis nowadays that we did have 20 years ago, because we didn't have the same coin that we were using. So I think that is one of the things that politics should do. And the other thing is that, and that is what I also hope to do now as a representative, is to represent Europe also on different levels than on the European level, so on national and the local level. So we'll definitely keep this report quite close at heart. And thanks again for inviting. And I'm looking forward to the questions, to open the discussion first.
Right. Well, thank you so much. I think maybe we can call this the assembly in Strasbourg the European Coffee House, and we can have lots of cups of coffee for us all to discuss. I think that's great. And I hope people in Britain who are no longer in the European Union can still join Volt. So that being pan-European doesn't necessarily mean being part of the European Union.
There's actually at the moment a campaign on rejoin the EU. So we're definitely still present in the UK.
Oh, good. Well, I'm part of that campaign. I mean, I should be part of that campaign. So that's great. So that's wonderful. So far we have, I'm going to ask two questions, and then I'm going to go back to the panel in a different order, and then we'll see if we have time for further questions. So let me just tell you what the questions are. So one from Sonia Prieto: perhaps the extension and deepening, real deepening, could be the real way for people to feel more confident about Europe. How many people, ordinary people, really know about the conference on the future of Europe? Why is it so difficult to make a real good communication about Europe? So that's one question. And the second question is from Eleanor Heim-Sewith, I hope I pronounced it right. From the presentation, it seems that the rise of a more proactive European civil society is primarily in support of the European Union. How has the rise of Euroscepticism, anti-EU movements, had any effects on the shifts perceived in the study? For instance, has the research also revealed a rise of anti-EU civil society groups, or rise of purely national civil society advocacy groups? I think that question is much more for Rock than, but I think everybody might have a go at it. And I just suggest we start in the opposite order. So I'll ask Marijke to start, and then we'll go backwards.
Sure, yeah. So to start off with the question about why is it so difficult to make a real good communication of Europe, in my view, I think there are two main obstacles about that prevent us from really understanding what Europe is about, and especially how the European institutes influence our life and how we can influence them back. Mainly, the first one, I think, is mainly that, at least in the Netherlands, speaking from my own experience, is that in our educational system, there is an emphasis on national politics and how national institutes work. So you kind of you're told from a young age how, for example, parliament works and how laws are being reviewed and how they pass, etc. But we don't put the same focus on how European institutes work. So a lot of it is in putting the same kind of importance to understanding European democracy as you put towards your own national democracy. Because we find that, I always found that a bit strange. We find it very important that young people know about how democratic institutes work on the national level and on the local level. And we teach them our constitution. But then we pay very little time proportionally to how Europe works and what kind of fundamental rights you have in Europe and how we protect them. So that's one thing. And I think the second thing why it is quite difficult to communicate properly about Europe and has a lot to do with the frame of reference where we start our thinking. So I think still a lot of politicians, but also companies, we still think from a national perspective, and we are convinced that protecting our sovereignty and our national interests is best done at the national level. And I think from, especially since the since globalization sort of started, and especially the last 20 years, you kind of see a trend towards not being able to protect your national interests and values because you focus only on the national. Because some things are a trend, a lot of things actually transcend borders nowadays. And we, in our thinking, haven't really quite caught up with the idea that sometimes it's actually you better protect your own sovereignty when you give away your power to the supranational. In this case, I think the European Union. That is a bit of an abstract thing to talk about, but I think it's the core of why it's difficult to really see the influence of the European Union. So I think for politicians and other kind of leaders or public figures, it is necessary to constantly show that, for example, European Union, when we have a climate accord, that is in our national interest. So it is actually better protecting our sovereignty and our values when we give away our competences in certain regards from the national when we move that to the European level, for example. And that might also go vice versa. So it might also be better to move competences to a local level, because that's where you can better have a dialogue with citizens, for example. But we have to kind of move away from the idea that the national is the most important. And that's when we can probably start a better conversation about Europe as well.
Could also be the other way around, that we'll never get away from it until we start communicating. But anyway, yeah. shall we now go to Mihaila.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really like this question because, truth be told, I actually didn't know about the conference on the future of Europe before I got asked to be a respondent in the survey. So I did not myself know about it, and I'm active in the civic space. In the preparation for this discussion, I took a look at the representative office of the European Commission in Slovakia, and there was one press release about it. And there was also one press release that went out through the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So I'm inclined to think that probably very little people, ordinary people, actually know that this conference is actually just about to take place. And why is it? I think I would definitely agree with Marike that there are some structural issues about how we talk about the European Union, and that it really isn't integrated in our educational system either. And it doesn't sort of go hand in hand with sort of democratic education. It's an add-on. It's definitely just something just a level further away from what we would generally learn. I would also say, though, that touches on the one press release, is that I feel like there's not enough communication from the EU towards the national level. I see a gap there as well. I also see that our own national politicians who represent us in the EU, they both sometimes don't take an active enough role to represent us, and then they do not actively communicate about the decisions that were made and where they where we were represented on their behalf. So I see that there is definitely sort of an our fault explanation as well here. And then there is a portion of the politicians which I think do proactively undermine the European Union, and often you know, take opportunistic positions and use EU as a scapegoat just to get more popular votes. So I think there's a it, to an extent, it's definitely a deep issue that will take a long time, I think, to actually overcome.
And the question is, of course, are we beginning to change? That's what we hope from this report. But I'm going to, Nicola and Rock might also want not only respond to these questions, but also might respond to Michaela's and Marijke's comments. So Nicola.
Thanks, Mary. I'm really pleased that the topic of citizenship education has come up, because I think that that's absolutely essential, and it's and we should call out in a way that it's scandalous that that this that citizenship education about European affairs is so poor. But not only is it scandalous, it's probably indicative of something else. And what I think it's indicative of is that people who are holding national power are quite reluctant to give up their dominance. And that includes politicians, but it also includes multinationals and financial interests and cultural players, even newspapers and media. People who are currently doing quite well out of the national system, or at least out of the combination of a national system and a largely dysfunctional European system, why would they want to change that? Why would they want to change that unless there is sufficient pressure to force them to do it? And I think that that's the beginning of an answer to some other questions as well. Why is it difficult to do good communication about Europe? Well, it's not that the European Commission and the European Parliament don't try. They actually spend quite a lot of money on this. The communication, though, is terrible, and it usually doesn't get anywhere near to the citizens. And when it does, it's very, very boring. They're somehow structurally incapable of communicating in an interesting way. And part of that structural incapability is that there's no political dynamic to it. And so the questions of, for example, the real politicization of the European Union, the creation of transnational political parties, it's what Volta's been doing with others trying as well, seems to me to be crucial to creating a kind of communicative dynamic inside the European Union, which people might find interesting and engaging. Another sign, a symptom of this, would be actually in the Dutch elections, where Marijke knows better than me, but I believe that there was plenty of discussion in advance of the elections, and suddenly people realized there wasn't so much discussion of European affairs. There was a campaign, the elephant in the room, on social media, saying, what about the European elephant? You know, the Netherlands' position on issues like financial solidarity in the COVID crisis is actually quite controversial, also in the Netherlands. Why aren't people talking about this? And so through a bottom-up campaign, it was forced onto the agenda. And no doubt the election results also partly reflect that. And so last comment, which also touches on the second question, is I think that we have to be a little bit careful about talk about European values and everybody having to agree with the same values. I think there's a truth in that, and it's important, but we have to keep a balance with rights. We should all have the same rights, that's also something that European citizenship should be about, right? What's the practical impact of European citizenship where it should give you rights and adequate protection of those rights? When we talk about what those rights should be, there should be more of them. That's what it means. It's not just a piece of paper. But we should all have the same rights, and there should be space for democratic divergence about values. And those values will be generated both through education, but also through political engagement. Political engagement in different political parties, in civil society, and we will find that we have different values, and that's fine as long as they're within some democratic bounds. And so I think that's also one of the things we were trying to show with the report, is that civil society, and that's the good news, has gone beyond a kind of stale debate about whether the European Union is good or bad. And at least certain parts of civil, European civil society have started to talk about what kind of Europe do we want. And that's the beginning of a formulation of values, which are not all the same, but which are articulated politically with a European dimension. I'll let Rock continue after me.
Thank you very much. Just briefly to respond to your insights about the report, I'm really pleased with your perceptions of this, especially Michaela, and especially that sort of trajectory of crisis, realization, response, and then organization. Like this is, I mean, this was not part of the research design. This was part of the finding, right? This pattern is being replicated across the continent, where different forms of activity were forged in response to the different crises, and then became parts of the public sphere, of the civil society landscape, and then started articulating new ways of action. So this is definitely something that was found itself in the report, thanks to you and thanks to others who signaled the same trajectory, including then advocacy on an administrative and political level, both European and local and national and local. Looking for funding more on the European level, because you don't have the support on the local, you don't have the resources on the local level, but you don't have the support on the national level, for example. So those transnational alliances, both in terms of ideas, but also in terms of structure and in terms of funding. But also something that you mentioned that needs to be addressed is this. Because we looked into the center of Europe from the margins, that there is this perception among the populations, national populations, especially in Central Eastern Europe, that somehow their voices aren't heard. And that is partly a problem of communication, of inability, of the lack of knowledge of how the European Union works, but also this somewhat sort of post-colonial position in which Central Eastern European societies find themselves in, or colonial, if depending on the country that you look at. I mean, those dynamics sort of overlapping and we shouldn't disregard them. We shouldn't disregard the perceptions of that people hold, and especially how then they translate into political action. This question of being included, being heard, being part of the discussion. Marieke, absolutely fascinated by the fact that you are a direct result of Brexit. This is something that I think maybe I read somewhere or heard, but it sort of escaped maybe I forgot about it. And also the idea that the EU is a means to an end and not a goal in itself, right? So I think we've moved past the founding fathers of the European Union, right? We don't no longer look at the EU as a sort of universalist incarnation of either Roman Christendom or the French Republic, for that matter, but a vehicle for something else. And this is especially visible again in Central Eastern Europe, where countries that have shed the yoke of Soviet control or even, you know, regain independence, like in the Baltic states, now see the Europe as a guarantor of national independence, of cultural diversity, of national sovereignty, etc. And again, and also your point about solidarity, that it's not about pragmatism, but about values, but about respect and respect for tradition and identity. And I think this is something that was very much missed in the debate about Brexit from the pro-European side. The Remain campaign was completely focused on the quid pro quo dimension of European integration, completely giving up this values-led argument, which really lies at the foundation of different modalities of European integration, including the European Convention of Human Rights and the European Union. And this is something that also is very much was visible in the in our in-depth studies in Southern and in Central Eastern Europe. So the experience of authoritarianism, whatever its dimension was, be that fascist or communist, means that those populations in those countries really see Europe as more than just a economic sphere. But I think in the UK it was also a result of a concerted effort of 30 years of ideology, both from the left and the right, just disregarding Europe and looking at it from an economic perspective. And I love the fact that you called Europe a cafe. I think Jürgen Habermas, if he was joining us here today, he'd be thrilled. In response to the question that Mary mentioned, so this report is only focused on civil society that addressed European issues or engaged on the European level explicitly. So there were very few examples of people who had a much more skeptical view on the process of European integration as such. Most of those of such civil society actors do not mention Europe explicitly if they're against it. However, this was the key for our methodological key. But these topics have been addressed within our research consortium. It's called Europe for the Many, europeforthemany.com. There are other reports about the dangers of authoritarian dangers to democracy because of COVID-19. There's a report called The Future of European Democracy about the decline of substantive democracy throughout Europe. There's a report on populist politics in Germany, and also a report on the visions of Europe among different political parties in the European Parliament. So those of you who are interested in that kind of in the right-wing populist or nationalist and anti-European mobilization can find more resources there at europeforthemany.com. However, our report focuses on civil society actors who, again, operate in the European civic space and seek change on the European level.
Thank you, Rob. Well, I think we've got a few more minutes, so I'm just going to take a couple more questions. I mean, one was really addressed to Michaela, but I think it's a more general question from Dara Powell, which was how can we represent normative progressive values when the majority of people might not hold those values themselves? I mean, that's a really big question. And the other, which is really addressed to Marijke, but I also think, again, it's a more general question, is Volt will participate in the Dutch municipal elections next year. How is Volt aiming to translate its pan-European ideas to the local context? And what could Volt's political agenda add to the lives of citizens on the local level? So I think that's a sort of, we could all be thinking about that question in general. And in order to get a completely different order, I'll start with Michaela.
All right, so I will address the question about how can we spread these progressive values in the society, if I understand it correctly. I think if I knew,
we promote European values in a society that has a very different set of values? How can we promote progressive values for you? Mm-hmm.
I think that's something that we're trying to work out every day, to be honest. I think that what we have come to and what seems to work or what has some proven impact, though that is quite difficult. Basically, because I work with the refugees and migrants, the values that I operate with most are, you know, solidarity, human rights, inclusion, diversity, anti-discrimination, anti-racism. And we're working with a so-called contact theory, that people, when they have a positive, constructive contact with a member of sort of a different group, they tend to have later on more positive views about this person. So what we try to do is organize community events and engagement events where Slovaks or locals from across Slovakia get a chance to meet someone who is a refugee or who's different, who's other, in a sort of a slightly facilitated or moderated manner. That's something that we do try to do as an organization. Secondly, and this is something that we have also planned to do some research on, is communication, good communication, especially from people who hold power over language, which tend to be politicians, public personas, media people, or people who are really sort of active in your eye or ear. They should start communicating more sensitively and inclusively about others. What we can do there is, you know, campaign, try to convince them to speak differently about refugees and migrants. But that is definitely a big chunk of work to do, but definitely not futile. And obviously, if there is more pressure coming from outside, from the level of the EU or from other organizations or institutions, that would definitely be supportive to this end. And generally, and that I am a big proponent of this, is good sensitive education. We have some contact with people at the Ministry of Education, and what they find is that there are a lot of NGOs actually who want to get their agendas into the curricula, and the experts in education tend to tell me that what you actually want is for people to be taught critical thinking and sort of sensitivity to issues. You don't necessarily have to teach them about migration and integration as such. So I think it's about sort of very in a very smart way, sort of design education from you know, kindergarten, primary, secondary schools, where these values are sort of integrated in a seamless way into, you know, what's just generally being taught. And I think that would be my three nuggets of wisdom, and I'll stop there. But I'm very happy to hear any other thoughts or suggestions for how this could be done. It's an area of interest of ours.
That's great. Okay, I'll go to Rock next. And actually, Rock, I think as well as whichever of these questions you want to take, I noticed in the chat somebody saying there's no European public sphere. And I actually think what we're discovering is an emerging European public sphere. So you might want to say something about that as well. Mm-hmm.
I think this is, maybe I'll take this one first. So I think this is one of our biggest finding. I think as much as there was a very much a positive momentum for building Europe on an institutional level throughout the decades in different regions of Europe, depending on the time when they joined the European Union or put together the European Union, and then that kind of waned and also was put under strain by the different crises. So we definitely see a huge discontentment with the European Union that still very much lingers in countries like Greece. But that disappointment with how United Europe works also led to a critical re-engagement. And I think the word critical here, being operative here, is that, again, like Marieke, most of those civil society activists that we interviewed, that we spoke to, don't fetishize the European Union. They don't love the European Union and its institutions, the Berlaymont. They don't have a portrait of Ursula von der Leyen or Jean-Claude Juncker, for that matter, under mantle, or even a little EU flag. This goes beyond that, absolutely. So they subscribe to a notion that is driven by values, that Europe is there to serve a purpose, and that is very much informed by their national experiences. So I would definitely argue against that comment. I would say that there is a European public sphere, but it's built through the sort of mosaic of different European stories that are woven into European history, and we cannot disregard this. Europe will always be something else for each of the countries, or even subnational groups and minorities involved. But also, it's forged through the recent experiences of crisis. And Marieke also mentioned media. I think right now, when we're looking at different national media landscapes and the way the recovery fund, the Next Generation EU, is discussed, we see a huge qualitative change in how regular everyday coverage on European matters unfolds. What is a European public sphere? Is it a news outlet that only discusses European issues? Absolutely not. And that's what we find. National issues are European issues. Local issues are European issues. For example, an issue that is very difficult in where I am right now in Poland are the so-called LGBT-free zones. So there are a few municipalities, or even one of the subnational voivodeships, that were adopted these pro-family proclamations. One of its stipulations being that this is an LGBT ideology-free zone. Those legislations were drafted by a right-wing think tank that is allegedly partially funded by the Kremlin, but is also very much in cahoots with the current administration in Poland, effectively rendering these municipalities LGBT-free zones, or at least in the public's perception and in the perception of the LGBT people living there. Many of those municipalities have now lost their access to Norwegian Liechtenstein and Icelandic structural funds. And are also now being interrogated by the European Commission for breach of Europe's fundamental values. Obviously, the government in Poland has come to their support, but we clearly see that places like Wila Mowice or Kraśnik, which none of you know where they are now very much embroiled in a pan-European conversation that involves values. The way we perceive and respect and treat LGBT people, European funding and political dynamics between the local governments, between the national government in Warsaw, between the European Commission, and between the different states, and very much in the global sort of sphere as well, because let's not kid ourselves, the anti-LGBT agenda in Europe is very much inspired by Vladimir Putin and his cronies and Alexander Lukashenko. And what is happening to gay people in Chechnya is akin to a genocide. And it's very much done for political reasons. So these people who who perpetrate these kinds of platforms and campaigns in Europe are very much on in cahoots with people like Vladimir Putin.
Gosh, what a fascinating example. And now to Marijke.
Yes, maybe to just also to sort of give an idea about how to talk or how to how to work with progressive values if we don't all hold the same values. I think earlier Nicola mentioned, I think, that we have all have the same rights, but we don't all have the same values. And I think that's really correct, that we should not move towards a Europe that sort of dictates what we should think. But there's a lot of gray area in between having the same rights and having the same values. I think that is what Europe should be for. We should have a dialogue about our values and get to understand each other within the boundaries of human dignity and basic fundamental rights. And I think the example of Rok just now in Poland is a clear example of lowering ourselves beyond that fundamental basis, basically. And to me, what is fascinating, we started VOLT, we have progressive values, that's very clear also from our policies that we have. And what was to me really interesting is that Europeans all over Europe kind of jumped into the VOLT vibe, basically. And they all sort of said, well, this is policies that I can get behind, from Poland to the Netherlands to Spain. And that to me is really interesting. I think values transcend borders, and that is especially why we should have that discussion or that dialogue on the European level. In my ideal worlds, in 50 years, we will also have transnational parties that run on perhaps conservative values. And we would have a discussion or debate on how you then eventually want to shape your society. And I think part of working towards similar values or to at least an understanding of each other's values is to create a support base. And that is, I think, where politicians also play an important role. So one of the topics I will be focusing on also in the parliament is migration and asylum. And one of the things we just sort of launched with VOLT Europe is the campaign called Europe Welcomes. And that is specifically the objective of that campaign is to show how many municipalities in all over Europe are willing and able to take in more refugees. And I think that's a great example of sort of having a dialogue in that sense and trying to create a support base for a particular kind of value of inclusion, of solidarity. And I think that is what politicians on all levels should work a lot more towards, to instead of just talk about policies, but to talk about what kind of society do you want and to create a support base. And that sort of leads into what VOLT might be doing during the municipality elections next year. That's always the core of where we start thinking about what can VOLT contribute on any kind of level, is what are the core values and what do you want to achieve in the society? And in this case, municipality elections, we will discuss what kind of municipality do we want? What kind of city do we want together? And in that sense, VOLT has a bit of experience because we already run in local elections in, Germany, Bulgaria, and Italy. And what usually happens, and I think that will also happen this year, is that we will look for best practices in other cities or other municipalities. So one of the things that I found fascinating is that VOLT Hamburg was running its campaign, and then they contacted VOLT Rotterdam. And they said, well, let's join our campaigns because we're both major cities that have a harbor and we both want to work to making that harbor more sustainable and to have sort of a green transition in that industry. And so there we can learn a lot from each other and that helps during the campaign by discussing that with people on the local level, with Dutch people next year, to discuss, well, what do you want to improve or what would you like to see different? And then to kind of discuss how other cities such as Berlin or Hamburg have already addressed that and how we could kind of easily borrow from each other. And I think there's, to be honest, I think it's sometimes easier to be a pan-European party on the local level because that's where people understand or we meet the same challenges. And especially when you look at cities all over Europe have the same challenges. And so it's way easier to then discuss the benefits of being pan-European and of having the same ideas. because it's just easier to borrow best practices from each other. And on a national level, it's sometimes harder because there we also meet not just what do you want to solve, but also what kind of tradition you have or what kind of identity do you have. So that's a far more difficult discussion. So Volt Netherlands or Volt Utrecht, for example, in my hometown, I know they're already preparing a policy program that is similar in line with our European and national policy program. And they're already discussing now with members of Volt, but also with just interested people all over Utrecht, what is it that you want to see different, or what do you find important for the next elections? And so that's how we will tackle the municipality elections next year.
That's great. Thank you so much. And we'll end with Nicolo. And Nicolo, I think one issue that came up earlier, in addition to these two questions, when Michaela was talking about, was she said she thought she liked the idea of the European Citizens Assembly, but, you know, who would be part of it? What power would it have? And I don't know if you have any ideas about that you might want to add. But also it might kind of lead us into thinking, how do we take this conversation further and how do we make it a contribution to the conference on the future of Europe?
Yeah, okay, I will come to that. I wanted to make, because I've got rather a lot of thoughts about that, so I will make two quick points first that I wanted to bring up. One is that in terms of promoting progressive, what we could call progressive values in a society which many people are not sharing those views, I think that one thing that's really important that we don't mention as much as we perhaps should in the report is what is problematically called the feminization of politics, which doesn't necessarily mean women leaders, although that can help, but it means a different way of doing politics, and a politics which is perhaps more focused on care for one another than on forms of toxic masculinity. And I think that the point I want to make about that is that there's opportunities. The world provides us with opportunities to change the way that values are developed amongst citizens. And this last couple of years of pandemic has made it clear to everybody the importance of themes like care and mutual support. And this real world experience is a basis on which we can regenerate a different society. So that was one quick point. The second quick point is again something that goes slightly beyond our discussion, but I think given the title of the event, it's worth remembering that earlier on in this cycle of crises, there were other insurgents with progressive values, led by men, actually, if you think of Syriza and Podemos. And just this last couple of days, we've seen the somewhat spectacular fall of Pablo Iglesias in the Madrid elections. And there's, of course, a lot of things to be said about that. But a kind of simplistic point I want to make is that perhaps Syriza and Podemos, in their spectacular election gains in the context of the financial crisis, were responding very strongly to social fracture, but perhaps guilty of something like magical thinking about the way the European Union really works and what it would be possible to achieve. I feel like one of the reasons for that is that they weren't embedded in a trans-European civil society that had consolidated its links and built understanding. And they were also quite distant from European institutions. My fear, what's great about the current situation is that we see that this European civil society is being built and consolidating itself. And there's signs of new political movements, of which Volt is one. My fear about it, and it's is that it may do the opposite. It may be very good at being connected across borders and knowing how the European institutions works, but not sufficiently attentive to the social fracture that is running throughout our societies, whether they're rich or poor members of the European Union or on the peripheries, all of them have this deep social fracture. Then thirdly, citizens' assembly. I think the important point is that if we create something called the permanent citizens' assembly, it can't have the kind of bureaucratic characteristics of the other European institutions. It needs to resemble much more the coffee house of Marika, or places where civil society can come, can run events, there can be cultural and festive activities, and it needs to maintain an experimental ethos. The ethos of the way European things are done is, to my mind, a really crucial aspect of the whole affair. It's one of the answers to why European institutions can't communicate. They're dominated by a bureaucratic ethos, and we need to have a vibrant civic ethos in any new institution. I think that there's discussions to be had about what's the best way of doing random selection, for example, for members. I'm not personally in favour of, for example, choosing 500 people and they stay there for the whole year. I think you would have a mix of different kinds of groups who may be gathered together for different purposes. We could have a week-long citizen assembly on migration, followed by 2-week-long citizens assembly on the environment with different groups of people. I think that not everything needs to be a kind of representative deliberative space. It should also be a space where minority groups can come in and run their own kinds of stuff. So what I'm saying is not a bureaucratic space which is too fixed in its ways, but an open and experimental space. That last phrase, that poses a big question about how such an experimental space could find its place in the formal decision making of the European Union. There, I think there's one thing the European Union is actually quite good at in comparison with member states is around consultation and expert input into policymaking. The problems that it has is that typically the people who participate and are able to exploit those opportunities for consultation and expert input are corporate lobbies. And what we need to do is to make sure the citizens can enter into those spaces as well. And that's kind of the space that I think a citizens' assembly would try to force itself into.
Well, thank you. That sounds really, really exciting. And thanks, everybody, for a very stimulating session in which I think there were lots of new ideas. So I hope we'll all meet again at future citizens' discussions about the future of Europe. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mary.